Today's guest is Nathaniel Schwartz, a homeopath in Berlin who I was fortunate enough to meet via Matthias and Doris Badner. Nate and I are both guest hosts for Matthias and Doris's upcoming summit, the Network to Heal Summit, which is running from 17 to 26 November and which you can view for free while it's running or purchase the package to watch afterwards at your own pace. You can register at www.networktoheal.de. So today, though, Nate will be sharing with us one of the most amazing stories I've ever heard of pure dedication and commitment when he recently went on an adventure with 20 homeopathic colleagues to the remote mountains of central Turkey in search of a healing plant that was believed to be extinct for the past 2,000 years called Silphium or Ferula drudiana. You'll have to listen to the end of the episode today as I won't be giving away any spoilers in the intro. Nate has studied and worked with many incredible homeopaths over the years, including Annalisa Adami, Dr. Ravi Roy, Professor Dr. Mohammed Kasim, Andre Sain, and many others. He also studied art, philosophy, and literature in upstate New York after completing his BA. Nate participated in various film projects such as the art documentary Hahnemann's Medicine by Alfie Mikesh in 2006, also Homeopathic World Theatre, a film by Thorsten Luders in 2007, and the film A Hypochondriac's Search for Healers by Rosa von Praunheim in 2014. In 2014, he began working with André Sain of Montreal and the Materia Medica Pura project and founded a proving group with his partner Catherine in 2015, who is also a homeopath, called the Hahnemannian Provers Commission. The commission now has some 50 members. Between 2015 and 2023, the group has conducted 19 new Hahnemannian provings. The result of the provings have been integrated into the monographs of the MMPP, the Materia Medica Pura project, and are being made available via Synergy in the Reliable Repertory and in Materia Medica bundles to the homeopathic community. Nate continues to teach live advanced seminars in homeopathy in Germany and other nearby countries such as Italy, Sweden, and Turkey. He speaks at conferences and runs a busy homeopathic practice next to the Grunewald Forest in Berlin, while trying to keep up with his two young children. In 2023, Nate began teaching online with his six-month course in German called Adaptogens and Organopathic Remedies with the Matthias Badner Academy in Germany. You can reach Nate at nathanielschwartz@yahoo.com. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to the Homeopathy Hangout, where we discuss all things homeopathy from around the world. And now my mum and your host, Eugenie Kruger.
Hello, homies, and a very warm welcome to Homeopathy Hangout. Today, we get to hang out with Nate Schwartz in Berlin, in Germany. Welcome to the show. Well, I should say Guten Tag.
Hallo, Guten Tag.
Now, you know, I can't say anything other than that. I can still just say, ich verstehe Sie nicht and Scheiße.
Oh, that's important. That's important.
And my kids taught me Regenbogen the other day, which I think is rainbow.
Oh, beautiful. Rainbow colors. Lovely. There's so many words in German that are actually English words. So if you know English, you know basically the half of German already.
Good. Well, and I know a bit of Afrikaans, so often you can go through those two. And then I just have to say, you have got the best homeopathic book rack behind you that I've seen in a while. I'm feeling woefully inadequate with my tiny little racky behind me. And you just a little swing around for me before, and you've just got a whole room full of books. That is very impressive.
Well, this is my library that's been built, has been building up for this practice I run in Berlin has actually been going for 40 years. So I'm the third homeopath to run this practice. So we've collected also a lot of books, and this is basically the library also I inherited and then added to. And so, yeah, it's gotten big.
Do you ever just sleep in it? Like, do you just go and get like a stretcher and a sleeping bag and just go sleep in there and just hope that all the information just gets absorbed into your auric field somehow?
I do that every evening.
Awesome. Well, I was super lucky to get to be introduced to you via Matthias Badner, who invited the two of us to be presenters for his Network to Heal Summit, which is going to be released just a few days after this episode goes out. So anybody who doesn't know about Network to Heal, this is actually like perfect timing for them. I think it goes live about the 17th of November. So people will have time to go register for Network to Heal. But do you want to tell our listeners, Nate, how were you first introduced to homeopathy?
Oh, yeah. It's a pretty amazing story with lots of twists and turns. Basically, I never had heard of homeopathy my whole life, growing up in America, where it's been, you know, basically had been snuffed out and slowly coming back. So I didn't know anything about it till I came to Germany as a teacher. And I was just not feeling well. I was just sort of not sure what to do with my life and suffering from some depression. And then a friend said, oh, why don't you go to this great homeopath? And I said, what is that? And said, oh, it's great. You will love it. So I was kind of procrastinating and I had her number, this homeopath he recommended who had saved him from an operation and who he loved. Yeah, anyway, finally, I just thought, what do I have to lose? I'll just try it out. And I went in and this lady was sitting at this Biedermeier-like ancient desk and she was writing with a feather, like you thought you're going into some kind of movie scene, you know? And she was writing with a feather. She was dipping it in the ink and she was writing. And while I was talking and there were all these antiques and all these books and it was really, you know, a special atmosphere. And I thought, what is she writing the whole time? And then she got up to get some tea and I thought, now's my chance. So I stood up and I went over to see what she was writing. And I was quite shocked to see that she was writing exactly what I said, word for word, and not some kind of interpretation, you know, Napoleon complex or something. And she just was putting it down. And that was quite a moment for me, and because I don't think I'd ever been taken so seriously by a doctor or a therapist up to that point in my life. I had always felt like I'm being put into some kind of a, you know, the drawers being opened and they're putting me into the drawer. I'm going to be categorized into this or that. And then sent on my way. So that really moved me. And then I got the homeopathic remedy and I was just blown away that it helped me so much. I couldn't believe it. I thought I was on drugs. And I called her and said, I feel so much better. Do I have to take this for the rest of my life to feel like this? And she said, no, that's actually how you're supposed to feel. That's how you felt probably as a kid or at some point before you experienced trauma and problems. And you're getting back to your true nature. And that's what homeopathy is all about.
That is so cool. And did the fact that you actually got up and took a look at the remedy as opposed to just sitting there nice and quietly would have given her a clue as to which remedy to give you as well, hey?
Exactly. Cheeky. Look how they're cheeky.
Very cheeky. Now, was this Annalisa or was this somebody else?
Yes, this was Annalisa Adami. So she was Italian who lived in Berlin, Italian lady who took over a homeopathic practice here. And she was just a brilliant person and a little crazy. And I just loved her as a person when I first met her. And later I fell in love with her and we were married and we were together for 10 years. So she was my introduction to homeopathy and homeopathic love story.
It is so beautiful. And did you two together go to India then? Because you studied there with, you said, Ravi Roy as well. Like, talk to me a little bit about the story from there.
Right. So then, yeah, she was convinced that I'm a homeopath. And you know how it is with homeopaths. They always see homeopaths in other people.
Yeah,
oh, why are you doing it? You should quit being an opera singer. Come on over here with that voice. You know.
I thought it was just me that do that. Do other people do that too? Other homeopaths?
Well, Annalisa used to do that to everyone. You know,
yeah,
what are you doing with your job? Quit that job. Move. Become a homeopath. So she inspired people. And you know, she saw the talent in people and the potential. And she said to me, why don't you become a homeopath? That would be perfect for you. And I said, this lady's really nuts, you know, because I was working as a teacher at the German university, in the German university system. And then I was really interested in Japan. And I was working for a Japanese art gallery on the side. And they invited me to come to Kyoto. And I thought, I'm going to Japan. I'm out of here. So I left Germany behind, went to Japan, started living there, started teaching there, got a job. And I brought all these books with me about homeopathy and I brought my first kit. Annalisa gave me a little kit of C200 potencies to take. So I had my first kit. I had some books, Homeopathic Love Story and Organon. And so I started getting into homeopathy and reading about it in the quiet nights in Japan in the countryside. So that's how I got into it more and more. And then on a fateful day, I got a letter from the same lady, Annalisa. She decided, after working for 20 years in her clinic in Berlin, that she was going to teach all of her knowledge once only to a group of people in Italy. And she was going to do the whole class outside in the middle of nature near Assisi. And I thought, you know, and then the way she pictured it, you know, sitting outside under the cypress trees, having fresh made pasta and learning homeopathy, I was like, okay, I'm going to this thing, you know, so I went to the first session from Japan and I loved it. And I decided to quit my job in Japan, give up everything I had created there and move to Italy and Berlin and start doing all these trainings. So I decided to delve into it.
Absolutely amazing. And sorry, where did Ravi Roy come into this? You went to India for a bit
Yeah, she had met Ravi Roy when she was a student. He's from the north of India and he studied in Delhi. And then he came to Germany as a young man because he thought, hey, homeopathy comes from Germany. I've got to learn German. I've got to go to Hanuman's, you know, home. And I've got to do homeopathy there. And so he came here as a young person and he started teaching homeopathy in the late 70s. So she was one of his first students and she loved him. And he's still around. He lives in the south of Germany. He's written like, I don't know how many, 40, 50 books on homeopathy, crazy number. And he's a brilliant guy. And after I started studying homeopathy, suddenly there was this offer. Who wants to come to India and work here as a homeopath in a clinic? Because at that time, there was a shortage of homeopathic doctors and shortage of medical care. You know, there's one doctor for 1,000 people up in the north of India. So they just love to have anyone come and help. So we decided to join this project and we spent several months a year. We were going back and forth from Berlin to Dehradun and joining in on learning Hindi, because of course you have to get pretty good at Hindi and Urdu. So we studied Hindi and Urdu and we spent months at a time with Ravi Roy working in his clinic.
That would have been a pretty spectacular experience.
Oh yeah. Well, the thing that was amazing, of course, among other things, was that you had people coming with presenting with things that we never see in the Western world, really, you know, necrosis, tuberculosis, and conditions that you just wouldn't find. Mm-hmm. And people would have been able to get care much earlier in our parts of the world. And also people just relied on homeopathy because they trusted it. And I got to see the results.
Yeah, that's the thing I often think is it would be really satisfying going to Africa or India or places like that where people are not, because of financial reasons, are not over-medicated on drugs because they literally cannot afford it. And so when you give people like that a homeopathic remedy, it would be so satisfying because their vital forces would be able to, you know, act so quickly on that. So you'd see pretty horrific things, but you would also have some pretty satisfying cures pretty quickly.
Amazing, amazing. I don't want to gross out anybody, but I remember a guy came, his son, it was really moving actually. It really brought me to tears because the son carried his father into the practice because his foot had basically rotted off and he just had this horrible necrosis and they couldn't heal it. You know, they had cut off a toe and then it got worse. And then, you know, what the way it works in allopathic medicine, you have to keep operating again and again. It costs a lot of money. So at some point they couldn't afford it anymore. So this huge open wound and I could smell it the moment the door of the taxi opened, like at 20 meters. And it was really moving to see this guy carrying his dad, who must have weighed like 100 kgs, incredible, into the practice. And I remember we treated him with calendula and that improved. And then he got the remedy that totally healed him was echinacea. And echinacea cured the septic wound completely. And I got to see the wound completely closed and happy family and no more pain and problems and suffering. So there were just cases like that, which were just amazing, you know, like bordering on miracle.
That is cool. Did you say echinacea or ignatia?
Echinacea.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Amazing. Yeah. So, so cool.
Yeah, because echinacea used to be used for poisonous wounds like rattlesnake wounds. And if a rattlesnake or an insect would bite and it would become septic in North America, the locals would have used echinacea, as I call it. They would use it to treat the wound, putting it out on the wound and also taking it internally, which is how we treated him too.
Oh, that is cool. That's cool. Now, how many languages do you speak? Because you just said that you learned Indian. You were in Japan, so I'm guessing you speak some Japanese. There's German, English.
Yeah. So I studied Spanish as well. And also a bit of Bahasa Indonesian, because I spent a lot of time in Indonesia and learned just a bit of the language. I was there for a few months at a time here and there, because I also was with Annalisa. We were teaching homeopathy. So she taught me, and then I joined her as a teacher in her second course. So she decided not to just do it once.
Oh, cool.
She started teaching again and again because she really loved it, got into it, and people heard how cool it was and how good it was. So one group after another. And so I was at a young age, and being a beginner, I was thrown into teaching again. And I guess that was my, you know, profession already. So I felt comfortable doing it. And so I was teaching homeopathy to beginners, sort of like Hanuman when he was a boy teaching the other kids ancient Greek, because, you know, after he was like in second grade, And the teacher said, you seem to know this stuff pretty well. Why don't you take over the class? You know, so it wasn't quite that severe, but she let me do some of the teaching. And we were also teaching in different places in the world, doing advanced trainings. And so we were teaching in India, teaching in Indonesia. And yeah, we were on the road a lot.
Now, I don't know if you know about our Bali conference in September next year, but you're going to have to come.
I heard about that, actually, yes. And that sounds amazing.
Yeah, it's going to be cool. So you'll have to come back so you can go visit Indonesia again.
I'm going to put it on my bucket list here for next year.
For sure. Now, talk to me about Andre's Sanus. Like, actually, maybe talk to me about the film project. There's so many things I want to talk to you about, but the provings, there's, your trip to Turkey, I definitely want to talk about. But talk to me a little bit about your work with the film projects.
Film projects, yeah. Mm. So we did this really cool film, which you can still get on Amazon. It's called Hahnemann's Medizin. It's Hahnemann's Medicine. It's also, it's German, but it has English subtitles. And it was done with Arte. I don't know if that's familiar to you guys, but that's in France and in Germany. It's like the biggest TV show, TV channel for documentaries. So they funded this huge documentary film on Hahnemann. So we worked and collaborated with this famous director named Elfi Mikesh. And we did a really cool movie with her about Hahnemann's life. And that was the first big movie I was involved in. I was just a consultant, basically. And for our main kind of the main figure who talks about Hahnemann's life and so on, we chose one of my other teachers from India, whose name is Dr. Mohammed Kasim. He's a fantastic homeopath who's practiced for over 50 years in Delhi. He's a beautiful person, amazing homeopath. So what we did is we flew him in from India to Germany and we went on a pilgrimage. So we went on this holy pilgrimage to the places where Hahnemann grew up, to Meissen, where he was born. His dad was a porcelain painter. We walked around the streets of Meissen, like feeling, oh, Hahnemann must have walked this street. And then we went to Torgau, where he lived when he was a little bit doing well as a doctor, and he had a big practice. And so we were going around to these different sites where Hahnemann was living and working and doing interviews with Dr. Kasim about Hahnemann's life, how homeopathy came to India, and all these great, interesting subjects.
That is seriously cool. I'm going to have to go check that out now. And I mean, that's just a thing, like in a place like Germany where homeopathy is obviously was born, but it's well accepted that you could get funding to create a project like that. How amazing.
Oh, yeah. No, Arte gave us 100,000 euros to do this film. So it has real actors in it and everything. Oh. And it shows how his, you know, there's a scene where he's riding in the carriage and then the carriage tips over and his son gets crushed under it and stuff. Oh. It was all these nightmare things that he experienced, him getting like, you know, thrown out of all these cities and people throwing rotten tomatoes at him and stuff. I mean, they didn't have tomatoes at the time probably, but anyway, probably some potatoes. Anyway, it's a really nice movie. Yeah, that was one of the film projects. And then we did a really nice movie about the way we teach homeopathy called Homeopathic World Theater. Because we also want all the students to really feel the remedy from within. And one of the ways we did that was to have them incorporate, embody the remedy and basically become like actors on the stage and present the remedy. And to up the ante, we registered for a theater competition, even though we weren't a theater group. And we said the homeopaths, they didn't know they were getting into this. We said, by the way, in a few days, we're going to be going on the stage as a theater group presenting homeopathic remedies, so that the people went nuts. They actually wanted to leave. And my wife, Annalisa, who is crazy, as I mentioned, she said, if you want to leave, that's fine. I'll give you all your money back. I'll go and do a one-woman show. I don't care. And the people were like, oh, we're missing a chance of our life. Why not go on the stage? Isn't homeopathy about having courage? Wasn't Hahnemann a badass in terms of being courageous? Okay, let's do it. So we did triturations of this was in the Alps. We did triturations of remedies that were growing at the time, like calendula, for example. Then we made little remedy pictures of those and then made performances that we presented in this open stage. And of course, the adrenaline was high. And we filmed it as well and made a movie about it.
Where can we get access to the movie? And have you got that translated as well?
Some of that movie, actually, I forgot to put one of my movies in the biography. There's yet another movie. I'll send you the link. There's a whole movie also. That movie we just distributed among ourselves, basically. Mm. It was really nicely made. We showed it in a few theaters in Berlin, but it's very, you know, specific to us. And you'd have to really understand a lot, you know. It's more for homeopaths, you could say. But we did a movie with a lady called Giovanna Poldi Alai. She's a documentary filmmaker from Italy. She made a movie about us, which is also online. I'll send you the link. It was one in a film festival about unusual, you know, people, unusual places and stuff, that kind of a film festival. She won a prize. And I think it's still on the website of that festival, so you can still watch it. But it's in Italian with German subtitles, I think. I'll have to check. Okay. I think it's in German and Italian. So, but if it's in English, definitely for the listeners, it's a cool film. Yeah, so that's that was a movie we did and a few years ago. And another one, there's another filmmaker got interested in us and made a movie about us. He's a really funny guy named Rose von Braunheim. He's a very famous German director. Like everyone knows him in Germany, like a household name. And he's this crazy dude. And he met us and he said, can you cure me? I have all these problems. And we said, oh, you're just the kind of guy. And he said, I'm actually a hypochondriac. Would you treat me with a film team present? And so we treated him. And I'm in that movie as a character. And among other, he goes to all kinds of crazy people who, you know, let's talk to the soul of your grandmother, and they're beating drums and lighting candles and stuff. He goes to all these nuts, crazy people in Berlin. You can find plenty of them, including us. And so we're in that movie too. Yeah, so we're in some different movies and promoting the good cause of homeopathy.
Oh my gosh. For anybody watching this on Rumble or YouTube, they will just see my jaw dropping on. Because like, Andy, you've done so many unbelievably cool things. And we're about to talk, because this is the main reason I wanted to get you on this show. Apart from the reason it's been really fun to hang out with you via Matthias and all these other things, but your story about the trituration of this plant in Turkey completely blew my mind. And can you please share that whole story with our listeners as well?
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure. Well, as you've picked up, we do a lot of triturations of fresh plants right on the spot. And that's the best way to do it, the way Hanuman did it.
Like on location. So you actually go to the plant, you triturate right there on location. Wow.
Then you know what you've got and you can be sure it's the right plant. Yeah. And you know, so that's the coolest thing you can possibly have. Of course, if you can't do it that way, you do it another way, but that's the best thing you can do. But it means traveling and adventure. So when on our travels, and my wife died in 2014, and I took over our homeopathic school and her practice and kept on teaching. I just decided to keep on bearing the torch and keep on working. And I kept teaching. So I was teaching in Sweden, in Italy, and then I was doing, you know, every couple of years, a big advanced training somewhere where we did in Sweden, for example, we did all of the trees that are used in homeopathy, like quercus and ginkgo. And we traveled as a group there and we triturated all these different trees in an ancient castle where they had been collecting trees since the 16th century. And it's amazing, you know, like Aesculus hippocastanum, you know, like the horse chestnut, it was like 500 years old, this tree. And it was amazing. We did one there. We did one in Italy, south of Italy. And then, so I love this kind of traveling and going with colleagues and in having an adventure. And I found, my mom sent me an article, actually. She's a homeopathy supporter. And she said, oh, this is cool. You'd like this. So she sent me an article about this lost plant called Ferula drudeana. It's also called Silphion in antique times. And basically, this is a plant. It's the first plant that human beings ever drove into extinction. So it's kind of famous for that. And it's famous because kings and pharaohs and everybody loved this healing plant. It was just really loved. Really famous, a panacea kind of thing. And it was already extinct at the time of Emperor Nero. Supposedly, he ate the last one and basically had been misused. And it's really hard to propagate it. And it's really hard to avoid it being eaten by sheep or goats or whatever, because it tastes really yummy. And it's really fluffy. It's in the fennel family. So it looks like something you want to eat. And people were eating it as well as using it as a medicine. So anyway, in this article, it said that there was a botanist from Istanbul who had spent his whole life studying the Ferula family. Ferula has 200 species. It's in the Apiaceae genus, and it has 200 species, 100 of which grow on this crazy big volcano in the middle of Anatolia. So it's south of Aksaray, and it's 3,300 meters high, and it's a volcanic soil, special environment. And this ferula thrives there, all kinds of different ferula. So he was wandering around. He spent 40 years researching, and he met some cowherders who were said, "Oh, you like this kind of plant? We've got some really awesome ones. They're really big and gnarly over here. Come and check this out." So he went with these boys into this little valley in the middle of nowhere. And he said, "Wow, this is a weird one. I don't even know this one." And the stems were actually like opposite each other, which is unusual for ferula. And it actually was a keynote sort of this ferula drudeana, this sylphion. He thought, "Oh, no way this could be sylphion." However, sylphion comes from north of Libya, from a village called Cyrene, and that's where it originally grew. And that was a Greek colony around 2500 BC, something like that. It started to be a Greek colony or 2000 BC. And by like 500 BC, it was a thriving Greek colony. So the Greeks had also had a colony on this volcano, believe it or not, and a place called Nora. So I thought, oh my God, it could be, he thought, first of all, he was excited. He went back to Istanbul, he investigated this plant, and it turns out, in order to know if, you know, a plant has healing power, you tend to look if it has secondary metabolites, which are basically, you know, ingredients that have medicinal power. And plants like, let's say, sage, or what are some other common ones, let's say like basil, or timian, you know, those kind of plants, they have, let's say, 4, 5, 6 secondary metabolites. So they're pretty strong and they do a lot of things. This plant that he investigated had over 30 secondary metabolites, which really suggested that it really was this lost sylphion plant. But of course, there were only a few of them left on Earth. So he was not keen to tell anybody where this plant was growing. But my curiosity just was so keen, I decided, okay, I'm going to go there and I'm going to look for it. So I thought, how hard can it be? I went there and I scoured this volcano and I couldn't find the damn thing, you know, anywhere. There were tons of ferula plants. I understand why he was researching there. You could find a ferula plant at every corner, but not that one, right? So in the meantime, I'd already written in my program that I was going to be teaching this plant and we were going to find it and we were going to triturate it. I was so confident. I thought the professor was going to work with us. He didn't want to. He wasn't against it, but he was kind of, you know, in mixed feelings. So he said, "No, I'm not going to tell you anything. You got to find it yourself, and I thought, okay. So we're going with 20 people, 20 colleagues to Turkey. I don't know where the plant is, and I promised that we'd find it. Oh my God, what's going to happen now? So luckily, the colleagues were interested in adventure, and I called this course Healing Plants of Antiquity. So we weren't just interested in that. They also have wild pistachios, for example, that grow there on this volcano, which is very rare. They usually only grow it at the ocean. And the sap of the wild pistachio, Pistachio lentiscus, is called also mastix. It's one of the most ancient healing remedies, you know, that you found in Egypt and Lebanon and Turkey and Greece. Mm-hmm. So we did a proving of that. We did a proving of a few other local remedies and ancient remedies. But on the last day, we were doing hikes every day. And every time we hiked, we were all looking around. Is that it? No, that's not. Is that one? We found tons of giant fennel and some other local species of fennel, but we didn't find this one until the last day. I don't know. It was just a luck or guidance of divine guidance. I don't know. I suddenly had this idea. I thought, okay, what do we have to lose? Let's go to this other area, not the area around this Greek settlement. Let's look in a totally different area, which just, I have this feeling we should go over there. And my guide, I had a mountain guide. He's like, "No, I already checked that. It's not that way." And I said, "I don't know. It just seems right to me." So we went that way. We hiked. It was hot. It was like 35 degrees. Sun was bearing down. All these homeopaths are stomping through, you know, hiking up this mountain with all these, you know, dried burrs and dried grasses all, and climbing over rocks. And finally someone's, "I found it, I found it." But it was just another ferula. So we are doing a lot of plant identification, part of our work in homeopathic pharmacy. Make sure you get the right one, because some of those fennel species are even poisonous. Long story short, suddenly somebody sighted one. They said, "Look, it's had the opposite leaves." And so we found together, we could say, we found together this amazing plant. There were just a few of them, And we obviously didn't want to dig it up and, you know, kill the last few, you know. So what we did is we just took a few seeds and we used those for the trituration. So we then triturated it together. 16 people triturated with us and we all triturated it. We all triturated to the C3 in this case. Then we all took a bit of the C3. We mixed it all together and it's our group C3. Wow. And I've given it to a pharmacist who's now running it up and is going to be giving us the higher potencies for approving.
That is just as spectacular hearing it the second time as the first time that you told me.
Well, it was an amazing trip and I'm really excited to see. Of course, when you do the trituration, you get symptoms. So that gives us a first indication, but it will, you know, be really exciting to do a Hanumanian proving and a blind proving, which we do a lot of those. So we're going to do that maybe next year and then we can share it with the homeopathic world.
Well, I'm part of a proving group with the NHTSA App Alliance, so we'd be happy to prove that for you as well. We've got a few things in the pipeline, but we're always happy to do more.
Oh, that would be awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. Have you got some photos of the area and where you were?
Sure. I can give you some photos.
Yeah. And it might be fun to share.
The plant, you know, it's exciting.
We've got a Facebook group, the Homeopathy Hangout Podcast Facebook group. It might be quite nice to put some of the photos up in there. I'd love to see some pictures of the plants and of you guys. I can see all of you dripping off.
Oh, yeah. See us all sweating. The people with they were, you know, using umbrellas because the sun was 2,000 meters. So the sun beats down on you. But interestingly, we're already sort of in the spirit because it's an adaptogen plant and it was, you know, kind of a plant like something like ginseng. You know, it gave you this extra power, extra energy. So people were just running up this mountain. So I was already thinking, apparently the remedy is already working, you know?
That is very cool. And once you are in kind of that consciousness of the remedy that you want to prove, you do start noticing things because Denitsa and I are about to triturate a remedy on Sunday. And I had something happen yesterday where I was in this real conflict and it suddenly hit me that this is actually part of the remedy that we're going to be triturating on Sunday. So I could really feel that difference. I'm like, oh, this must be a theme of the remedy. I could see that link. But as you were talking about triturating trees, I've got a mission for you. There is this baobab tree in Tanzania in Africa that is 6,000 years old. I think we should make a trip out there and go triturate that. 6,000 years. I mean, how amazing is that? I don't know if it's true. I just saw this Facebook post and it said this baobab is 6,000 years old. It's in Tanzania. I'm like, okay, we need to go hunt that down and go triturate that. We do have baobab already.
That's all about. Imagine how excited Hanuman was. He started out, he didn't have a single remedy. He just knew about them. He had heard about them. And doing the Apoteco Lexicon, this book about, you know, he was writing this book or being about all the different healing remedies since antiquity, but just sort of like as a scholar. Mm-hmm. And he must have been so excited. He'd been like, I want to go to the Isle of Socotra. That's, you know, right. That's part of Yemen, this island that has all these species and all these plants that no one has ever seen. And there's just like some pirates and sailors who are telling the stories about Aloe Socotrina. And he was like, must have been so excited. That must have been his life dream. Like, I got to get on not a plane, but on a boat and go to Socotra. And, you know, what an amazing trip that would have been. But my teacher for trituration, Britta Gudjons, she lived that dream. She actually went to Socotra on a boat and triturated aloe right there on the beach, fresh plant. So cool.
That's cool. I didn't even know there's a place called Socotra. So that's obviously where the word Aloe Socotrina comes from Socotra.
Yeah, it only grows there. It's aloe plants grow all over the place in the world. But this plant only grows there because it's separated from Africa millions of years ago. And some of those plants, like in New Zealand, Australia, they went and did their own thing.
Yeah.
So that plant only exists there.
Cool. So cool. And speaking of adaptogens, you are doing a series of courses with Matthias on adaptogens and organopathic remedies, right? I don't know anything about it. Can you tell our listeners a bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. One of the things that I do in my practice, I have a practice in Berlin, of course, and treat people, you know, as much as I can possibly do. I'm always trying to keep up with it. I use a lot of organopathic remedies and low potencies, as well as very high potencies. And that's a bit unusual in homeopathy. People tend to sort of go in a certain direction and they find their potency niche. And because I had all these different teachers, such as Ravi Roy, who uses a lot of D potencies and mother tinctures. In India, they also use a lot of lower potencies and tinctures. And then I also studied with Andre Sain, who uses the highest, like like million, 2 million, 3 million, 5 million, 100 million, billion, whatever. It just keeps going up and up. So I've trained with these lower and these very high potency people and masters. So I use them all. And Matthias said to me, nobody really knows that much about all these, you know, low potencies, tinctures, using tinctures and homeopathy. Is that actually homeopathy? And on the adaptogens, do homeopaths do that sort of thing? And I said, yeah, actually, Hahnemann was one of the first. Have you read the case of the washerwoman? Everyone knows that case, or plenty of people know it, because he only published two or three clinical cases in his whole career. He was sort of against that because he said, you know, people get the wrong idea. They'll think this remedy is for that condition. But he did publish one where a washerwoman who lived in a nearby village had, I don't even remember what her problem was exactly. Did she have a bronchitis or back pain or some? She had some severe problems. She couldn't work. And he gave her bryonia and the mother tincture. And bryonia is an adaptogen. It's an adaptogen plant. And she was cured. And the reason it went down in history is that one of his homeopathic students was listening in. And he said to Hahnemann, yeah, but how do you know she got cured? He was a skeptic, you know. She didn't come back. So, you know, maybe she died or something. And Hahnemann said, here's her address. Check it out, dude. So the guy, you know, got on his horse or whatever, rode a few kilometers. It was apparently like 10 kilometers, like pretty far away. And he finds this lady working and doing her washing. And he says, hey, why didn't you come back and see the doctor? And she said, I don't think you know much about washerwomen. You think I can miss a day of work, go get on a horse, ride over there to tell him I'm feeling well? You're nuts. And then the guy understood and said, okay, so you're totally cured? Yeah, I'm totally fine. I can work again. So she was restored to health with bryonia mother tincture. So yeah, I'm teaching a course about adaptogens and organopathic remedies and low potency remedies. It's a course in German and it's online. So I taught that. It was a 6-month course beginning of this year and people were happy and enthusiastic. So I'm doing part two in December. I'm going to keep going and I'm going to do a whole new set of subjects because adaptogens are really cool because you can really work miracles with conditions that are, you know, considered incurable or very difficult to treat and so on, with especially with higher potencies. You can go in with other tinctures, low potencies, and you can give something that really brings things forward. So that's something that's going on at the same time.
I am a huge fan of organopathic remedies, especially in this day and age when people's, you know, so many organs do need support because they've been on lots of pharmaceuticals. So lots of organs are really weak. And it's just like a little gentle tune-up for those organs. And you can see where the disharmony lies. You give them something like that. I actually like to use organopathic remedies in a low potency. And then I get them to put it in their water bottle, shake it and drink it throughout the day, because then I can give them other remedies that they take like once in the morning, like higher potency remedies. And then I usually get them to do the organopathics just in the water bottle and also at the same time encouraging them to drink more water. So then you kind of, I always say, put that remedy wherever you fill your water bottle up. So you hopefully they have a filter somewhere where it's filtering the water or the chlorine and the fluoride out. Put the remedy there. And then every time you fill up your water bottle, just put 2 pills of that organopathic remedy in there, shake the bottle and then just drink it throughout the day. So they're getting that gentle stimulation.
Brilliant. Everyone's brilliant. Well, that's exactly right. And I do the same with putting in water and having them take it regularly or just knowing about them because people are taking all this stuff anyway. So you need to know, or I say, I need to know, what does Tulsi tea do? You know, what is Tulsi? For example, it's an adaptogen plant, holy basil. People are taking it, at least in Germany, it's pretty famous. And people are taking it in supplement form, in extracts, in tea. So if you don't know the action of that remedy and what it does, how can you tell a person whether they should take it or not, how much to take it, how to take it? So I just feel in our time when people are Googling stuff and trying out all kinds of stuff, we did a proving of the reishi mushroom. That's also Ganoderma lucidum. It's also an adaptogen mushroom. And people are hearing about it and they're taking these, you know, mushrooms, but which mushroom? So we do provings to find out more about the individual aspects of the remedy so that we can also then prescribe it individually. So it's just not just a liver support remedy, but there are hundreds of liver support remedies. Which one? So we try to do it homeopathically.
I do like mushrooms. I've actually just finished my chaga chai. So Amy, who works with me, she has her own little business called Happy Patch Herbals, and she makes this kick-ass chai with black tea and the chai spices and chaga mushrooms. And I gave up coffee a while ago and I find this completely this really helps me not crave coffee at all. And it's just so delicious. But I think the other reason I really like organopathics is because I studied naturopathy as well. And I also worked in a health shop for a few years. And so it feels natural for me to want to give something in a herbal form, but just in that, you know, that low homeopathic potency. So instead of the actual supplement, which sometimes can put more stress on the liver, if you're putting somebody in a whole bunch of supplements, it's got a lot of binders or additives or preservatives. But then if you just give them, say, ginseng or whatever in homeopathic potency or taraxacum in homeopathic potency, it makes so much sense. So I do get
it. It does. And you can really, and you then can tell the patient, because they have this urge probably, you know, they want to take a few things. Mm-hmm. They want to support their liver. They want to improve their vision or whatever it is. And then how are you going to tell them, you know, don't touch this stuff kind of thing. Mm. So you don't touch the stuff generally, yes, not without discussing. But then say, yeah, you could do that. That would be good. And then also bringing that into the homeopathic treatment in the sense of if it's a very sensitive patient, they might be developing symptoms from the supplements and from the other things they're taking. So being aware of all the things they're taking, and especially with sensitive patients, then deciding what potency, because they might do better with a D6 or a 6X or 12X or 30X because they're so sensitive. They'll react to a tincture too strongly.
I just have to say, sometimes I speak English and Afrikaans. I don't know of any homeopathic books in Afrikaans, but you know, we've got so many in English, and of all my books, I have probably there's a good half or a quarter of them that I still need to read. You know, I think like most homeopaths, a book buying addiction. So I buy all these books. I just never have time to actually read them, but I am so glad I do not speak German, because then I would have even more books that I'd want to buy and not read. But that must be actually like a double-edged sword for you, or like, you know, it must be so hard because you have access to all our amazing English books, but also all these incredible German texts. That must be really incredible, but also like a curse, a blessing and a curse at the same time.
It's really true. Well, there's a lot of source material in lots of other languages, especially German, of course, but also in the European languages, because homeopathy spread, you know, to France and to Spain and to Portugal and so on. And the Materia Medica project that we mentioned briefly before with André Sain, we're working together, homeopaths from 15 countries, to gather together all the literature that we have about a certain remedy in Portuguese, in French, in Swedish, in Italian, and then translate it all into English and make it available in one monograph. Because often there are these golden nuggets, like you'll have, you know, there was the plague broke out in Naples, and you had this homeopath treating hundreds of people with the plague, you know, and he's documenting all his cases. And he's giving, you know, Veratrum or whatever, or Ignatia. And then you can include those remedies into the monograph, and you can see what the remedy can do and what it can't do. And not just some kind of theory like, oh, Ignatia is good for this or that, but actual cases. And then based on the cases, you find out what is the real meat of the matter and what is the soup of the soup. Mm. Because, of course, you know, a remedy gets famous for a certain condition, like Hahnemann was afraid of. And then somebody says, oh, Boerica used to like that remedy. And so they just keeps going, oh, that was Kent's favorite or whatever. Mm. And it turns out like that game where I don't know what it's called. And I think they call it telephone or something in the States, you know,
yeah.
The kids whisper, you know.
Chinese whispers. Yeah.
Chinese whispers. By the time you actually get to it, you're like, wait a minute, what is that remedy? You know, and what is it good for? So this project is all about collecting all of the source material, all these cured cases, over 200 years, bringing them all together, analyzing them, putting them into the repertory, because a lot of that stuff never made it to the repertory. And then when you do that, then it's really amazing. Like we did a proving of Hydrastis canadensis, which is famous for as a cancer remedy. Like it's the remedy that cures cancer. Well, that's what Clark said, for example. In an article, he said, yeah, I'd say that Hydrastis is the remedy that cures the most cases of cancer. So there you go. It's like well, today
wildfire.
You would, you know, post that on all Instagram or whatever, or on Facebook, like we've got the cure for cancer.
Goes and viral.
All he was saying was the most of, compared to other remedies, it seems to help the most or whatever. So one of our colleagues, Roland Mettner in Germany, he wrote a monograph. I think it's 600 pages. It's incredible work. For years, he worked on it. He collected all the cured cases of Hydrastis over 200 years in all these different languages, put them all together. And then he saw, oh, you know, actually, Hydrastis very rarely cures cancer, actually. There are only a few cured cases in the whole history of humankind. However, it helps a lot. It's a liver supportive remedy and supports the digestion. It does have anti-cancer properties. However, when you can't really find in the literature cases where they just gave that and the person was cured, but you found hundreds and hundreds of cases of people who were cured of cancer who also took Hydrastis that helped them along the way. So it needs another remedy often to then complete it, or, you know, it's basically a supportive remedy that's very helpful with cancer. However, if you put all your cards on that or all your chips on that hand, you're going to lose the hand probably. And if you just know, it's great. I thought that was like a revelation because when I had cases of cancer, like let's say a pancreatic cancer, and that which is often, you know, kills the person in no time, I was thinking, okay, just go, it's Hydrastis fits, just Hydrastis, go with that. And the guy died. So that was before I knew about it, that it does have its limit of action, its stop point, as Burnett says. And that was really interesting to know about that. That's just information we should have as homeopaths. It'll save lives and help us to be better.
Yeah, I think we're not immune to Chinese whispers. And I've talked about it on the podcast a few times. And the case that I always use is that we were taught at college to give a bowel nose ode once and never repeat it within 3 months. And then I did Hilary Dorian's bowel nose ode course. I got really brave because she said prescribe it daily for 21 days. I'm like, oh my gosh, 21 days. And these days I prescribe it daily for 2 months and just get such good results. And the reason I'm so annoyed that we were taught that is I just think of all the amazing work that I could have done if I wasn't made to be scared of a bowel nose ode. It's just a remedy like any other remedy. Like some people are really scared of nose odes. Like somebody told me, an Indian homeopath said to them, you use tuberculinum like gold. You spare it for, like, you know, these cases, and you give it once and you don't repeat it. And I'm like, it's just all such BS. Like, we need to actually just look at the case in front of us and yeah, look at the cured cases. Okay, which remedies have been successful and how were they used? And, but yeah, well, you know, we're just human at the end of the day, right?
Right. Well, this is a phenomenon, of course, that affects every area of science, you know, that you just get this little bit of information and then you just scale it up and this cures that. You never do this. You know, all Mexicans are like this. All Americans are like that. Instead of stereotyping, basically. Yeah. And stereotyping, it creeps into all of our thoughts. It affects our unconscious mind. You see somebody on the street, you say, oh, I better go to the other side of the street because they have a different skin color, or they're big, small, fat, thin, whatever. I mean, it's always affecting us. And so we have to be aware of it. And Hanuman actually warned us against it all the time. And he was constantly experimenting. At the same time, of course, he was quite doctrinaire and, you know, he was a dictatorial or whatever in his writings. But if you actually look in his case books, he was really experimenting wildly and trying all kinds of stuff. So he was trying to figure out the best course of treatment for each person. And that's exactly right. That's what we need to do. And question, you know, Twilight of the Idols, question all these things. That's why I like Andre Sain. He's such an idol smasher. And he's written an article, for example, it's called Herring's Law, Rule or Dogma. And he goes back, he says, where does Herring's Law come from? And he goes back into it and he finds out Herring never actually mentioned that in his entire life. There's not one place in his entire work that Herring ever talked about a rule or some law, much less a law. And says, where does this come from? Everyone is teaching this in schools and they're all learning it and it'll affect your practice. You think, oh, the eruption came on the head and the eruption used to be on the feet. Maybe this is bad or whatever. So, you know, the order of things, it can cause a lot of confusion. And he said, well, if it's a rule or a law, we should find out about it. Hanuman must have mentioned it. Everybody must have been talking about it. And then he found the source of this whole so-called law is a lecture of Kent, who quoted something he learned from Herring, who then quoted Hanuman, who said in psoric cases, it tends to happen that things will, the symptoms will come from within to without, from top to bottom, and in the reverse order of appearance, tends to happen in psoric cases. Oh, that's the quote. Oh. That's where it comes from. And it became first a rule and then a law. So that's how these things happen, you know?
Wow. It's kind of hard not to like draw that parallel with, I'm just thinking with like the real scientists who just say, oh yeah, vaccinations are safe and effective because one person said it once and then everybody believes it. So I guess we're not immune to that after all, are we?
Hanuman said that we have to constantly train ourselves as observers of nature. He recommended that homeopaths draw, for example, like still lifes, you know, like do a still life painting or draw a person's face not what you think it looks like, but what it actually looks like. You're like, oh yeah, you know, Oishini, she's got this kind of nose, more or less like that. Not more or less. Look again. Oh yeah, her eyes, they're sort of like, no, look again. Check it out. What are you interpreting? What are you making up with your unconscious mind that's not actually there? So yeah, there's a beautiful quotation of Hahnemann in German where he says, our job as observers is to see all that is there without adding anything to it.
Mm. You just made me think of this book called Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain. I did this drawing course like 20 years ago, and there was this book. It was so good. Drawing on the Right Side of the Brain. I don't know who the author was, but they did exactly that, like teaching you to draw what you see. And then, you know, our teacher would give us to have a pencil. And, okay, so draw where the ears actually are. So you do, okay, well, the forehead's actually like a third of it, and the ears are like half the head. And so when you actually go and sit there, you actually, that's how it is. And the shoulders are actually like a head, like a face width on each side. And you're like, wow, you know, because you wouldn't think that when you draw it. But when you actually go and sit and you look at it, it's quite fascinating. I just had to add that bit there.
Yeah, absolutely right.
Yeah. Now, Nate, where can people get hold of all this information? How can they contact you? How can they learn from you? How can they find out more about all these things that you do?
Well, I have a pretty low profile website because I'm just always trying to keep up with everything. But on that website, you'll find my email and my number. So feel free to just get in touch. You want to do provings, you're interested in treatment, in studying, whatever. I'm happy to help you. I can maybe pass you on to someone, or I can recommend something, or you can come and see me. Why not? And love to be in touch. I love new people, love new doing new things. And I think that's why I and you as well, Eugenie, we're going to be working with the Berners, the Matthias and Doris Berner, this November in this Network to Heal, which is going to be in English for the first time. They used to, you know, they obviously have a lot of English speaking people who are homeopaths who they've interviewed for this conference, but the conference was mainly in German and a lot of German speakers. So it's become bigger and bigger and bigger. It's been going on for 10 years. And now they've decided to branch out. They've given a new name. It used to be called United to Heal. Now it's called Network to Heal because it's network around the world of people who love homeopathy and practice homeopathy, studying, learning from each other. So they asked both of us, they wanted to get more international. They asked us to do some interviews. So I'm going to be doing interviews as well this in the next weeks for the conference with homeopaths who I think are awesome, or healers who I think are amazing. So basically kind of like what you do, you know, I love this podcast format. It's so cool. I'm jealous because this is my kind of thing too. I just love.
Well, you just started a podcast too. We need more. We need more homeopathy podcasts. Go for it. I think we've got about 20 already, but you know what? I always say everybody does. We all do things in a different style. We come from a different angle. So we can never have enough podcasts. Like, go for it, Nate. I would listen to your podcast.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Well, I'm going to do these interviews now. And so that's going to be exciting. That's a good way to get to know me. Mm-hmm. And on this Matthias Berner Academy, I'm teaching, it's in German, but just to know, and maybe at some point I'll teach in English as well. We just started that off. That's a new thing, teaching online. And I teach courses in German in different places in the world. So yeah, that's sort of the things that I've gone on at the moment. And what I'm really excited about is this Network to Heal that's coming up, and then these new proving. So we've got all these really great projects, and it's just amazing how we're meeting new people, and this podcast is evidence of that, you know, just making connections from country to country and from person to person to strengthen and to teach each other. Absolutely. Nobody's got the holy grail of truth. We're all, as Hahnemann says, we're like in darkness, and we're kind of like tiptoeing through the darkness, trying to find the truth. And that's what we're all doing, I think.
Oh my gosh. I have interviewed 3 of the guests for the Network to Heal so far. I mean, this is October now when we're recording this, but, and this actually, today's Friday, the 13th of October. So this episode is going to go out in exactly a month, but I've interviewed Peter Tamanello, who's going to talk about GEMS that's used in trauma post COVID, and Isaac Golden, who's going to be talking about the fallout of the COVID vaccine and the statistics that he's been collecting during COVID, which is fascinating. And also Ian White, who created the Australian bushflower essences. And he's going to be talking about his Australian bushflower essences specifically for trauma, for bushflower essences to help clear spike proteins, to help with electromagnetic radiation. They were just 3 absolutely epic interviews. I've had all 3 of them on my podcast before, but we're going to be talking about different things on this recording that was done for the Network to Heal Summit. So I hope all of our listeners go and register for that because it's going to be amazing. I think it's over 10 days and there's dozens of speakers. Amazing. It's going to be
so many speakers. It's like 50 speakers and it's all free during the time of the conference. It's free to listen to. And then at the end, you can buy this little package and then have access. But you can do it for free or you can support it by buying it. Either way, enjoy it. And I think that's something I'm really excited about at the moment.
Me too. I cannot wait. And it was so cool to actually get to have a chat with you. I mean, we get to chat like little bits when we have our meetings with Matthias, but to actually sit down and hear your story was just such a privilege and so amazing. Thank you so much. Dankeschön.
Bitte schön. Sehr gerne.
And auf Wiedersehen.
Auf Wiedersehen.